Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Temperatures in Europe have increased at more than twice the global average over the past 30 years, the highest of any continent in the world, according to a report released Wednesday by the World Meteorological Organization, or WMO. It shows that as the warming trend continues, exceptional heat, wildfires, floods, and other climate change impacts will affect society, economies, and ecosystems. The State of the Climate in Europe report focused on last year and provides information on rising temperatures, land and marine heat waves, extreme weather, changing precipitation patterns, and retreating ice and snow. High-impact weather and climate events led to hundreds of fatalities, directly affected more than 500,000 people, and caused economic damages exceeding $50 billion. About 84% of the events were floods or storms. With just a few days to go before the opening of the UN Climate Change Conference, the UN Human Rights Chief has issued an open letter calling for human rights to be at the heart of efforts to tackle climate change. High Commissioner Volker Türk warned on Wednesday that our right to life is being threatened by insufficient action in the face of the climate emergency. He said that the COP27 climate change conference in Egypt is critical for people's effective enjoyment of human rights around the world, not just in the years to come, but now, adding that people are losing their homes, their livelihoods, and their lives.
And we see that how important it is in COP27 that agreements are reached that move us ahead on climate financing, on loss and damage, but also that put us away from the trajectory that we are on now that could see the rise in temperature of 3 degrees. You can imagine what this means, even in the lifetime of our children, because many parts of the world will become uninhabitable as a result, and that's disastrous for human rights.
Mr. Türk said that disasters such as the recent flooding in Pakistan are destined to become a recurring nightmare for people across the world if dramatic, rights-based action isn't taken to respond to global warming. A free press is vital to a functioning democracy, exposing wrongdoing, navigating our complex world, and advancing the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, said the UN Secretary General on the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists. Antonio Guterres said that a surge in disinformation, online bullying and hate speech, particularly against women journalists, is contributing to the stifling of media workers around the world. In addition, intimidation through the abuse of legal, financial and other means is undermining efforts to hold the powerful accountable. The Secretary General said that these trends threaten not only journalists, but society as a whole. More than 70 journalists have been killed so far this year. Between 2006 and 2020, over 1,200 journalists have been killed around the world, with close to 9 out of 10 cases of these killings still unsolved. Impunity leads to more killings and is often a symptom of worsening conflict and the breakdown of law and order. Nikki Chadwick, UN News.
Lay your hands on the radio! Lay your hands on the radio there in the home!
Blog Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What do you know you can't explain? But you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there. Like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio for Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Representatives of Ethiopia's government have reached a deal to permanently halt hostilities with people in northern Tigray region. The peace deal announced Wednesday capped a week of African Union-mediated talks in South Africa aimed at bringing an end to the two-year-old war that sparked one of the world's most worst humanitarian crises. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo led the negotiations.
The two parties in the Ethiopian conflict have formally agreed to the cessation of hostilities, as well as to systematic, orderly, smooth, and coordinated disarmament.
All parties to the Tigray war have been accused of war crimes. The peace talks did not include Eritrea, whose forces joined Ethiopia's assault on Tigray. Eritrean troops have been accused of massacring hundreds of civilians and other war crimes, including widespread rape, sexual assault, and looting. The United Nations says 5.2 million people in Tigray are in urgent need of humanitarian assistance. By some estimates, up to 800,000 people have died as a result of the war, which are erupted exactly 2 years ago today. We'll get the latest later in the broadcast. In Ukraine, the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant has again lost its connection to the power grid after fighting damaged high-voltage lines. Ukraine's national nuclear operator blamed Russia for the outage and said the plant has once again had to rely on backup diesel generators to prevent a radiation disaster. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council has rejected a Russian bid to order an investigation into unsubstantiated claims Ukraine and the U.S. are carrying out military biological operations in violation of an international convention. Only China sided with Russia in approving the resolution Wednesday, with other Security Council members voting against or abstaining. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other top diplomats from the G7 are meeting in Germany today to discuss support for Ukraine. The meeting comes after the Pentagon confirmed active duty U.S. military are deployed inside Ukraine and have, quote, resumed on-site inspections to assess weapon stocks. This is Air Force Brigadier General Pat Ryder.
My understanding is they would be well far away from any type of frontline actions. We are relying on the Ukrainians to do that. We're relying on other partners to do that. We've been very clear. There are no combat forces in Ukraine, no U.S. forces conducting combat operations in Ukraine. These are personnel that are assigned to conduct security cooperation and assistance as part of the Defense Attaché Office.
On Wednesday, the UN said some 14 million people have now been forcibly displaced since the February Russian invasion of Ukraine, calling it, quote, the fastest and largest displacement witnessed in decades. In Washington, D.C., a witness testified Wednesday that the head of the far-right Oath Keepers militia tried to contact then-President Trump 4 days after the January 6th Capitol riot to tell him it was not too late to use paramilitary violence to remain in power. Military veteran Jason Alpers told a federal jury he never delivered the message from Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes. Instead, Alpers says he warned the FBI about Rhodes' threats of violence. Jurors also heard audio of Stuart Rhodes declaring that on January 6th, quote, we should have brought rifles, unquote. Rhodes also said he would have killed House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. He's expected to testify today in the trial. With less than a week to go before midterm elections, President Biden warned political violence and lying politicians pose a growing threat to democracy and are putting the United States on a path to chaos.
This intimidation, this violence against Democrats, Republicans, and nonpartisan officials just doing their jobs are the consequence of lies told for power and profit, lies of conspiracy and malice, lies repeated over and over to generate a cycle of anger, hate, vitriol, and even violence. In this moment, we have to confront those lies with the truth. The very future of our nation depends on it.
In his prime time speech at Union Station just blocks from the Capitol Wednesday evening, President Biden refused to name Donald Trump, but said the former president's lies about the 2020 election results led to violence against election workers and tragic events like the January 6th insurrection and the attack last week on Paul Pelosi, the husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. According to the New York Times, over 370 Republican candidates in the midterm elections have questioned or denied the outcome of the 2020 election. New emails shared with the House committee investigating the insurrection reveal Trump's legal team saw Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas as their only chance to help overturn Trump's 2020 election loss. The former president's lawyers wanted to orchestrate events so Thomas would be in a position to cast doubt on Georgia's vote count before Congress proceeded to record electoral votes on January 6th. Meanwhile, Trump lawyer John Eastman warned against lying about having evidence of voter fraud in Georgia, writing, quote, "I have no doubt that an aggressive DA or U.S. attorney will go after both the president and his lawyers once all the dust settles." In Wisconsin, Republican gubernatorial candidate Tim Michaels threatened permanent GOP rule if he wins his election.
Republicans will never lose another election in Wisconsin after I'm elected governor.
Michaels made the remark during a campaign rally Monday, raising fears he would further crack down on voting rights in the swing state, which has been heavily gerrymandered to favor Republicans and is already governed by a Republican legislature. Conservative Wisconsin lawmakers have introduced hundreds of bills this year restricting voting rights. Incumbent Democratic Governor Tony Evers tweeted in response, "Tim Michaels is a danger to our democracy. When you head to the polls on Election Day, remember that we're fighting to protect our democracy, voting rights, and free, fair, and secure elections," unquote. Federal prosecutors have granted immunity to a close associate of former President Trump in exchange for his testimony. Kash Patel will appear before a federal grand jury to answer questions about Trump's mishandling of classified documents after the FBI recovered hundreds of records, including many marked top secret, when agents carried out a search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in August. Patel previously claimed Trump declassified the documents when he left the White House. Meanwhile, some top strategists are expecting Attorney General Merrick Garland to pursue an indictment of former President Trump within 60 to 90 days after Election Day. That's according to the newspaper The Hill, which reports an indictment would most likely be for Trump's violations of the Espionage Act in connection with the Mar-a-Lago documents. The U.S. Federal Reserve has ordered the sharpest interest rate hike since the 1980s. On Wednesday, Chair Jerome Powell announced the Fed's fourth consecutive 0.75-point increase and warned further hikes may be necessary. Powell said the Fed's overarching goal remains bringing inflation under control, even as he acknowledged the rate increases now look likely to trigger a recession.
My colleagues and I are strongly committed to bringing inflation back down to our 2% goal. We have both the tools that we need and the resolve it will take to restore price stability on behalf of American families and businesses.
The Fed's actions have pushed mortgage rates to their highest level in 20 years and threatened to end a period of historically low unemployment. Liz Shuler, president of the AFL-CIO, Federation of Labor Unions, said, quote, "Working people should not be the target of lowering inflation. It should be corporations that are earning record profits." Israeli troops have killed two Palestinians in separate incidents in the occupied Palestinian territories. In the West Bank, Israeli troops shot and killed 42-year-old Daoud Mahmoud Khalil Rayon as they raided a home of a man accused of ramming his car into an Israeli soldier. Elsewhere, Israeli authorities in occupied East Jerusalem say they shot and killed a Palestinian man who stabbed a police officer, they said, lightly wounding him. This comes as Benjamin Netanyahu is set to reclaim his former role as prime minister after a tally of late results from Israel's election showed his far-right coalition with a nearly insurmountable lead. Former Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan has been shot and injured during a rally in Punjab province. Khan's supporters say he escaped an assassination attempt but was struck in the leg. Imran Khan was 6 days into a high-profile journey from Lahore to Islamabad to call on the government to hold a snap election after he was removed from power in April. In Florida, a judge has sentenced Parkland school shooter Nicholas Cruz to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Cruz killed 17 people in a 2018 mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Ahead of Wednesday's sentencing, survivors and victims' families were given an opportunity to confront Cruz directly in the classroom. This is Samantha Fuentes, a former classmate of Cruz, a survivor of the massacre.
You were a hateful bigot with an AR-15 and a God complex. You still are, minus the gun. You might have everyone else fooled, but not me, because this is personal. Racism is not a mental illness. Perfectly planned and articulated manifestos and plans are not characteristics of the sickly or the mentally unhinged.
Samantha Fuentes and other survivors of the attack have become prominent gun control advocates, speaking in court yesterday. In Jackson, Mississippi, federal and state officials have declared the city's water supply to be in compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act. This follows a boil water advisory across Jackson that lasted nearly 7 weeks after flooding on the Pearl River led to a system-wide failure of the city's water supply in August. On Monday, hundreds of Jackson residents rallied outside the governor's mansion to hold the state of Mississippi accountable for the water crisis. The protest was led by Bishop William Barber of the Poor People campaign.
Majority black and brown and low-income communities are left to suffer the devastating consequences of crumbling, outdated water infrastructure.
And in Michigan, residents of Flint have asked a judge to intervene once again in their long-running campaign to replace the lead pipes that led to the mass poisoning of Flint's water supply, as well as a deadly outbreak of Legionnaire's disease. It's the fifth time in 6 years community groups have asked a court to enforce an agreement requiring the city to take action. Melissa Mays, organizer with the group Flint Rising, said, quote, the people of Flint won't tolerate any more broken promises from the city, which is under a federal court order to get the lead pipes out of the ground and somehow still can't get the job done, she said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the series of crises that are plaguing the nation of Haiti.
We'll be hearing from Brian Concannon, and we'll learn about the level of corruption and repression that is going on in Haiti with the backing of the U.S. government.
Attorney and author Carrie Schenkman joins us to talk about his new book on the Espionage Act.
We will explore why the Espionage Act is such a dangerous statute to go after journalists who reveal U.S. war crimes. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Haiti is a nation in crisis, spiraling out of control since last year's assassination of its president, Jovenel Moïse. The government has cratered and 200 violent gangs have seized control. There's no fuel, and food and water are hard to come by. Businesses and schools are shuttered, and hospitals, banks, and grocery stores teeter on the brink of closure. Clean water is scarce, and Haiti faces another cholera outbreak. An estimated 1 million people are starving in the middle of Haiti's biggest city. Kidnappings, human trafficking, homicides, and sexual and gender-based violence are rampant. Last week, the UN Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution demanding an immediate end to violence and criminal activity in Haiti. It calls for sanctions on groups and individuals threatening peace and stability in the impoverished nation. The sanctions resolution implicated Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, whose gang has blockaded a central fuel terminal. Cherizier is a former police officer leading a group of gangs known as the G9 Family and Allies. He now faces asset freeze, an arms embargo, and a travel ban. Joining us to talk about the imperiled nation is human rights attorney Brian Concannon. Brian is executive director of Project Blueprint and the founder and former executive director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Brian has been qualified as an expert witness on conditions in the country of Haiti in more than 40 cases in courts both in the United States and Canada. Brian, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you, Julie. It's good to be with you. I will note, I'll update my bio a little bit. I am back with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. As things got worse in Haiti, I felt called to come back to that work.
I was actually going to ask you about that. Thank you for that clarification. Brian, you lived in Haiti from 1995 to 2004, where you managed a public interest law firm and served as a UN human rights officer. You left Haiti in 2004 after the U.S.-sponsored coup d'etat overthrew Haiti's democracy. What did that coup reveal about the possibility for long-term progress in Haiti?
Well, I'll start by saying that the public interest law firm that I worked at was called the Bureau des Avocats Internationaux. And one of the co-founders, we use the acronym BAI, one of the co-founders of the BAI was Michael Ratner. And Michael not only started the BAI, which is still our sister organization, he inspired everything that we in the United States at IJDH, but also the Haitian lawyers at the BAI are doing. We're really trying to continue his legacy, which makes it a special honor to be on with you today. The 2004 coup, that was a coup that was financed and to some extent executed by the United States government. That marked the end of Haiti's longest experiment in democracy, an experiment that was very fruitful for the Haitian people. Haiti's social criteria went up almost across the board, whether it was nutrition, healthcare, education, governance, the basic foundations of democracy, our work, justice. But the problem was the Haitian governments refused to accept the dictates from the United States on their economic policies. The Haitian governments kept insisting that in a country where you still had large illiteracy and very low access to health care, that they needed to expand government services, when the United States insisted that Haiti actually cut its government budget. The United States' way of showing its concern with Haiti's economic policies was to literally kidnap the president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and send him on a plane that was taken from Guantanamo Bay. It was the same, one of the planes that was used in the rendition of torture, of people who were tortured in the war against terror. They filed a false flight plan and deposited President Aristide in the Central African Republic. That marked the end of Haiti's experiment in democracy, and Haiti has not come even close to the level that we were there. It convinced me, you know, I loved living in Haiti. It was a really exciting place to live, but it convinced me that I needed to come back, that my place was to come back to the United States to really bring Haitians' fight for democracy here, because too many decisions about Haitians' rights were made in the United States.
Brian, what impact have natural disasters and the blockade of a key fuel terminal by armed gangs in Haiti had on the nation's many other problems?
Well, it's important to situate the current acute concern, which is the fact that gangs are controlling over half the country and are blocking fuel, which is causing a lot of misery. But that's really a short-term symptom of a broader problem. The broader problem is that since 2011, a right-wing government under the PHTK party has been very persistently dismantling Haiti's democracy. The dismantling has a lot of symptoms, but some of the highlights are there has not been a parliament in almost 3 years. The Supreme Court does not have a quorum. There has not been an election that was either on time or fair in the last 10 years. And Haitians have been suffering pretty steadily over the course of that time. The international community, especially the United States, has supported the PHTK and, as Haitians say, continues to prop up the government. Haitians think that they've taken to the streets enough to force a change in their government, except for the fact that the U.S. administration is now propping it up.
Brian, thank you. On October 9th, 2022, the de facto Prime Minister of Haiti, Ariel Henry, wrote to the UN Secretary General asking for military support to deal with Haiti's catastrophe. But the Commission for a Haitian Solution to the Crisis, also known as the Montana Accord, opposes foreign intervention. Could you please unpack this for us within the context of the historical dilemma that you've just explained to us?
Sure. The Haitian government's request for foreign assistance, it cited the pretext was gang violence. But gang violence has been at an acute level for at least 3 years now. And it's important to note that many of the gangs have their power because of the government. The government has been supporting gangs as long as gangs are attacking neighborhoods that are supportive of the opposition, especially the Family Lavalas Party, which is Haiti's largest progressive party. Back in 2019, I went down along with Representative Maxine Waters to investigate a massacre against a neighborhood that was organizing demonstrations against the government and that was supportive of Lavalas. And we were told that this was done for political reasons. And ever since then, there's time after time, whenever there's large massacres, the victims keep saying, we're being targeted because of politics, because the government is sending gangs against us so they can control the voting booth if there are ever elections, and so they can suppress dissent. And that's a key factor that we need to keep in mind. And with the government is saying it's gang violence, but first of all, the gang violence has been there for a long time. Second, the gang violence is government supported. The real problem, the real reason why the government is calling in international troops is that the protests have spread like wildfire across Haiti. And for the last 6 weeks, people have closed down the country to protest to try to get the repressive, corrupt government out. Haitian government does not want help fighting gangs. They want help suppressing protests, and they want the international community to continue to prop them up. And that's really what's at stake, and that's why it's not, the Montana Accord does not want, has opposed intervention, but so have Haitians. Haitians are taking to the streets by the tens of thousands, despite getting shot at by police, to say that they don't want intervention. Haitian media is saying everybody doesn't want intervention. It's only really in the United States where people are talking about this as being something that is, you know, that is desired in Haiti.
Brian, what accountability issues come with providing aid to another country? You have previously said that after the earthquake, there were sustainability issues when people were sending food and when U.S. healthcare workers went down and volunteered. Please elaborate.
Yes, we've always advocated for what we call a human rights-based approach to humanitarian aid. And what we're asking for is accountability so that the people who are going down to, and they're raising money in the names of Haitians and they're going down saying they're going to help, that they actually have, that they allow some way of Haitians holding them responsible for what they're doing. We're calling for transparency where you can actually see whether that money is spent well. We're calling for participation, so involving Haitians in all processes rather than just parachuting people down from abroad to do something and then leaving. And then last is we're calling for sustainability, as you mentioned, so that people who are coming down leave something so that there is some kind of sustainable structure to provide those basic services when the foreigners leave. And that's something that if anybody is serious about wanting a better day for Haiti, you would do that not just in disaster response, but also in things like food aid. You know, one of the chronic problems in Haiti, like elsewhere, is that food aid, it treats the symptom by getting hungry people food, which is good, but it does it in a way that in the long term makes Haiti less able to feed itself. So often food is given, it's subsidized food from the United States, and it's delivered in a way that puts Haitian farmers out of business. So for a while, Haitian consumers get cheap food, but next year when the Haitian farmers don't have the money to plant their seeds, food is more expensive in Haiti. And that's really hitting Haitians now, as you're having, you know, we have inflation in the United States, and we think it's high, but Haiti's inflation has been over 20% for 2.5 years now, much worse than ours. And these are people who are spending 30-40% of their budgets on food. And so they're really cutting down the calories they are eating from an extremely precarious level to even worse now. And if Haitians been able to have a better, a stronger local agricultural production, you'd have less hunger in Haiti right now.
That is such an important issue for those of us in the U.S. to understand. I want to circle back to, I asked you a few minutes ago about the de facto prime minister, Ariel Henry, seeking military support. Can you tell us a little bit more about him? Who is he, and what was his relationship to former Haitian President Jovenel Moïse?
Ariel Henry is a doctor. He actually has had a notable career as a doctor. He's also been involved in politics in Haiti for the last 20 years. In 2004, he was part of this U.S.-appointed group that helped consecrate the coup d'etat against President Aristide by naming a new prime minister. And since then, he's been involved in a few different parties, most of them on the right side of the spectrum. And over the last 4 years, he's been a minister in several governments by the PHTK party that has run Haiti for the last decade. He was nominated by President Moïse before President Moïse's assassination, the day before, actually. He was never installed, and in fact, immediately after the assassination, the international community said it was recognizing the existing prime minister, a man named Claude Joseph, as the continuing prime minister. The way that Henri got into his job was that a week and a half later, the core group, which is a group of non-Haitian countries that is organized by the United States and led by the United States, they put out a tweet saying that they now recognized Ariel Henry as prime minister. So he was installed not through any process, any Haitian process, not because any Haitian voted for him or confirmed his candidacy, but because the core group sent a tweet. And ever since then, it's been clear exactly where Dr. Henri's constituency is, and it's among the United States and Haitian oligarchs and the PHTK party. He's now been in office for 15 months, and he's ruled in a way that has continued Haiti's dismantling of democracy. He continues to arrest dissidents. We actually had last month at our colleagues at the BAI in Haiti, they heard about 50 political prisoners being held in the country's largest police station. Because the city was on lockdown, you weren't able to drive. They had to walk 3 miles through gunfire in the hot sun to get to the police station. And they found that, yes, in fact, that there were dozens of people who had been arrested because they were participating in or leading legal protest activities. And so the government's really doing a strong crackdown on dissent, while at the same time doing nothing to rein in violence by gangs, especially gangs that are supportive of the government. And let me add one more thing about the prospect of international troops, because this is one of the reasons why Haitians are so opposed to it. This has already been tried before. From 2004 to 2017, there was a UN mission in Haiti. It spent $9 billion, which is a lot of money, and it could have done a lot of good in Haiti. And in fact, they didn't do much good. They left Haiti less prosperous and less democratic than when they got there. the way that they fought gang violence was to hunt down suspected gang members and execute them. That did reduce violence in the short term, but it also undermined the rule of law. It did not address any of the underlying conditions that make gang violence inevitable. And as a result, you have a rebound in gang violence to where we are now. So Haitians are, obviously they have the right to choose, they should have the right to choose whether they have international intervention. But in this particular case, they have very good reason for opposing it.
In addition to protesting corruption and gang violence, as you mentioned, protesters are also critical of the UN and the U.S. Why is that?
Well, the UN also brought cholera to Haiti. That was a case we've done a lot of work on. In 2010, the UN dumped cholera from one of its peacekeeping bases into the top of Haiti, dumped sewage that had cholera in it into the top of Haiti's largest river system. The epidemic killed somewhere between 10 and 30,000 people and sickened over a million. And not only that, that's obviously a huge toll, but to many Haitians, almost as bad was the fact that the UN first denied that it did it, even long after it had been scientifically proven they had. But then they've just refused to take responsibility. We represented the victims and claims with the UN system. We took the case to federal court in New York, and at every step, the UN couldn't defend itself on either the law that it didn't have a responsibility or on the facts. What the UN said at every step was, you can't make us comply with our legal obligations. And that is really their defense, that they're above the law. Haitians take that as a slap in the face, especially from an organization that had been lecturing Haitians on the rule of law for a dozen years. And that has left a bitter taste and also has left Haitians with little reason to believe that the UN is going to do better this time.
I want to ask you this, Brian. We've heard that former U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti, Daniel Foote, has joined in with the criticisms of U.S. policy toward Haiti. Can you help us understand his criticisms and why he has taken this position against military intervention?
Sure. Ambassador Foote was named Special Envoy a little bit over a year ago. He didn't last long. I think it was less than 2 months. He resigned, and he resigned because he, as he explained in a letter, he was asked to do the impossible. He was asked to try to find a solution, to help find a solution to Haiti's political crisis. But while he was trying to find this solution, the United States kept propping up the current government, and he felt that it was impossible to reach a solution while you're propping up the government that is the problem, and he resigned in protest. Haitians agree with that analysis. I mean, they've been taking to the streets to say that. And what's happening now is that Ambassador Foote resigned to protest that the U.S. was propping up through political and economic support, and what is now being proposed is just increasing that support to military support. And that is, I agree with Ambassador Foote, as do most Haitians, that there is no way that continuing to prop up a repressive, corrupt government is going to lead to a resolution of Haiti's crisis.
What dangers do protesters face in Haiti?
They're getting arrested in large numbers, and also, the justice system that in the past has protected all sorts of people trying to exercise their right to expression has been sharply dismantled. The Supreme Court does not have enough justices for a quorum. The main courthouse in Port-au-Prince was taken over by a gang on June 6th and has still not been retaken. Most courthouses on most days are closed, so you can't even get to a judge, and that's allowing the government to hold people indefinitely. But the government is also shooting at protesters, shooting at journalists who are covering protesters. Yesterday, a journalist was found tortured and his body mutilated. His radio station is accusing the government's prosecutor of being behind that for years, journalists have been saying they are fearful, and there's good reason. At least 6 journalists have been killed this year. And so there really is very little accountability for the government, and it's allowed to almost do what it wants other than the protest. I mean, and despite the fact that protesters are getting shot at and jailed, Haitians are still taking to the streets in the thousands, tens of thousands. But the international forces is designed to stop that. So if the international forces are deployed, you will see them continuing to shoot at the protesters and doing other ways of suppressing legal dissent that Haitians are doing, which is just going to allow the government to continue consolidating its base and continuing to be repressive and corrupt.
I want to go back to the level of gang activity that is currently going on and sanctioned by those highest in power. Can you tell our listeners about how these gangs are using children by recruiting and arming them into their efforts?
Yeah, over the past few years, there's been a sharp increase in gang membership, and some of that is driven by economic desperation in the poor neighborhoods, but even that wasn't enough to fully supply. So there has been both directly forced recruitment and indirectly forced recruitment. I mean, the directly forced recruitment is somebody threatening a man or a boy to join the gang or else. But what else is happening, and we're hearing this as being much more prevalent, is people are struggling to get by, and the gangs will offer a young man or a boy a little bit of money so their mother can pay rent or they can buy food for the family, and the kid will accept that because they need to. At that point, then the gang says, well, you now owe us, and that's leading people into joining the gangs.
In his first year, President Biden deported thousands of Haitian migrants to Haiti from the U.S.-Mexico border. What has the impact been of those deportations?
I believe the number was 23,000, so it was quite a bit. That's a big chunk of people for a country like Haiti. The impact on the individuals was great. Most of those people had fled because they were being subject to persecution, other violence, or just could literally not find enough to get by. And so they were placed back in a position where they had fled to. From a community standpoint, it was also difficult because you had families in Haiti that were struggling to get by, and all of a sudden you have 25,000 more people put back onto that, you know, with no jobs, with no ways to make a living, and that added to the strain of all Haitians. According to research by the Haitian Bridge Alliance, which is doing great work both at the border and advocacy in Washington, D.C., as well as some research back in Haiti, that most of the people who get deported, they immediately try to find a way to leave because things are so bad. So it's almost like a vicious circle that people who are sent to Haiti just immediately try to get to South America so they can recommence the journey back to the United States. And the U.S. needs to treat everybody at the border legally and humanely. But if the administration really wants to reduce the challenges of the influx of Haitians at the border, what it needs to do is to stop supporting the repression and corruption in Haiti that is driving the migration in the first place. Most Haitians want to stay in Haiti. That's their home. That's where their families are. That's where their communities are. But as long as we make it impossible for them to live dignified, safe lives in their communities, they are going to flee and they're going to come to the United States.
Brian, in light of the whole picture and the tragic situation in Haiti, what do you think should happen now to improve the situation there, and what can we do in this country?
What Haitians are asking of the United States isn't that we spend money, isn't that we send soldiers, it's that we stop propping up their repressive, corrupt government. It should be an easy, inexpensive thing to do, but the administration refuses to do it so far. So what Haitians are asking the rest of us to do is to pressure our government to stop supporting the repression. There's been some work done by Haitian Americans. We had a protest 2 weeks ago at the White House. There's been solidarity groups who have many petitions. I'll urge people to check out our website at www.ijdh.org to find out more of what you can do. But mostly what Haitians are asking us is to stop our government from doing this repression. And we think that's doable. Just 2 weeks ago, we had several members of Congress, including six senators, wrote to the administration telling them to stop propping up the dictatorship. There was a report in today's paper that the U.S. is frustrated that they can't get any other countries to send soldiers to this proposed mission. I think that's in large part to the Haitians' advocacy and people outside of Haiti supporting that. So I think this is a winnable battle, but we just need to apply more pressure to get the U.S. to do that. And you mentioned earlier at the top of the show, you talked about sanctions of some of the gang leaders. And I think that can be impactful, but it's important to note that there have been sanctions against Jimmy Cherizier, one of the largest gang leaders, and two government officials since December of 2020, so Trump administration sanctions. And they have not borne any fruit as far as I know. So if the U.S. isn't going to enforce sanctions from 2020, it's hard to see how these sanctions will make any more difference. The arms embargo, it's not as if that, you know, the gang leaders are placing arms orders through the internet. I mean, it's being smuggled. And the United States, they're all coming from the United States. The United States can either seriously act to stop the flow of arms, or it won't. It doesn't need a UN resolution for that.
Brian, can you remind us what is the website that people should go to be able to further follow you and the work that you do?
It's wwijdh.org or haitijustice.org.
Brian, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Okay, keep up your great work.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
For more than a century, the 1917 Espionage Act has been used by the United States government to target critics of its foreign and military policy. From suppressing criticism of U.S. participation in World War I to present-day attempts to silence whistleblowers, political dissidents, and journalists who expose our nation's war crimes, the Espionage Act is a dangerous weapon in the federal government's legal arsenal. It has been employed to limit freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of information. In their new book, A Century of Repression, The Espionage Act and Freedom of the Press, Ralph Engelman and Casey Schenkman trace the use of the Espionage Act against Eugene Debs, Daniel Ellsberg, Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, and Julian Assange, among others. During World Wars I and II, the act was primarily directed at political opposition to government policies. During the Cold War, it was used to criminalize leaks, manipulate the flow of information, and mold public opinion. And during the so-called War on Terror, the act has been used as a means to combat digital disclosure and journalism. Journalist Julian Assange, founder and publisher of WikiLeaks, is currently locked up in a maximum security prison in London while the Biden administration attempts to have him extradited to the United States to stand trial on Espionage Act charges that could result in 175 years in prison. The basis for the indictment against him is WikiLeaks' revelation of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Kerry Shenkman is our guest on Law and Disorder today to talk with my co-host Heidi Boghossian and me, Marjorie Cohn, about the historical development and use of the Espionage Act. Kerry is a constitutional lawyer and litigator focusing on freedom of expression, transparency, and technology. He serves on the panel of experts at Columbia University's Global Freedom of Expression Program and consults on media rights issues before the United Nations and around the world. Kerry Shenkman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Why was the Espionage Act enacted in 1917? Is it really just aimed at spies and people who commit espionage?
Not at all, and this is one of the biggest misnomers about the Espionage Act. Even though it's titled the Espionage Act, its scope historically is extended to forms of conduct well beyond traditional espionage, such as spying in the employ of a foreign power. So the act was enacted following the April 1917 call to enter World War I by Woodrow Wilson. It was primarily targeted to German Americans and those opposed to the war effort. And I think what truly frames the impact and intention behind the Espionage Act was Woodrow Wilson's call for legislation to target those that were opposed to the war effort. And in his speech calling for U.S. entry into the war, he said, quote, "If there should be disloyalty, it will be dealt with a firm hand of stern repression." Of course, our book is titled A Century of Repression, and that quote, we felt, underlies the whole 100-year history of the Act and how it's been utilized to suppress dissent.
Kerry, how was the Act used during World War I?
So the Act, and in fact, the first 2,000 prosecutions really didn't have to do with spying. While it did establish penalties for traditional spying, the Act was at first used against the industrial workers of the world, against the, also known as the Wobblies. It was used against Eugene Debs and the entire leadership of the Socialist Party. In fact, Eugene Debs famously gave his Canton, Ohio speech, for which he was prosecuted and convicted under the Espionage Act. He famously ran for president from prison, and his imprisonment was a result of the Espionage Act.
In what ways was the Espionage Act used during World War II?
So moving into the Second World War, we saw continued use against the anti-war movement. A interesting thread that we track that hasn't received a lot of attention is the Act's use against the black press. And the Espionage Act was instrumental in the rise of the career of J. Edgar Hoover and the formation of the FBI. So the original enforcer, if you will, of Espionage Act prosecutions was a man named John Lord O'Brien, who is the head of the Justice Department's War Emergency Division. And back during World War I, he had hired a then 22-year-old J. Edgar Hoover. Now, J. Edgar Hoover had his politics really shaped by the repressive environment of this period, as well as these Espionage Act cases. So what we saw in World War II was really a continuum of what J. Edgar Hoover had learned during the First World War. The shameful aspects of that history was J. Edgar Hoover's targeting of the black press. And in fact, the FBI had threatened to use the act against the black press during World War II. This is really a continuation of J. Edgar Hoover's actions following the First World War, where he issued reports, one titled Radicalism and Sedition Among Negroes is Reflected in Their Publications. There is a famous quote that he gave that, quote, the Negro is seeing red. And his worldview was to consider people of color as disloyal. So during World War II, we saw a continued effort to go after black publications such as the Chicago Defender, the Baltimore African American, etc., which had advocated for civil rights and were thus seen as disloyal and in opposition to the war effort.
Kerry, in what way was the act used during the Cold War?
So during the Cold War, we definitely saw a shift in the introduction of McCarthyism. And in some respects, actually, going to back to J. Edgar Hoover, there are arguments that McCarthyism should really be called Hooverism. But during the Cold War, we really saw a shift from the use of the act to curb dissent against war efforts to really a tool for information control. And during the Cold War, we saw the formation of the NSA, we saw the expansion of the classification system, and we saw in 1950 a great amendment to the Espionage Act. One of the most important cases that we highlight is that of Amerasia. So Amerasia was a small foreign affairs journal that covered East Asia issues, and it was highly respected within the State Department, particularly among a group of China experts who are known as the China Hands. And at the time, there's a great debate within the U.S. government about the future of China and East Asian policy. And many of the China Hands took to providing information on background to the press, including documents, because the U.S. was at the time on a disastrous course that ended up being a precursor to the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Now, what happened is there was an Espionage Act prosecution of the editors of this journal, as well as those as several of the China Hands within the State Department, and it was actually those targets of that Espionage Act prosecution that became the very first targets of Joseph McCarthy. So in his Wheeling, West Virginia speech, he named China Hands such as John Service, who were very respected in the State Department, but he named them as part of his so-called evidence that there was communist infiltration of the State Department. So one of the things that we really uncovered was at so many of these pivotal points throughout the 20th century, the Espionage Act was such an important part behind the scenes in these dramatic repressive moments.
What about the case of Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers?
So fast forward two decades, and we have the Vietnam War, and Daniel Ellsberg, who was a very respected government employee at the time, provided documents to a number of news outlets that were known as the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret study that revealed that the U.S. had, in fact, lied about the reasons geopolitically for entering the Vietnam War. That led to a very big showdown between Nixon and the press that led to a Supreme Court decision that prevented the Nixon administration from enjoining the New York Times from publication. But that didn't stop the Nixon administration from going after Daniel Ellsberg and Anthony Russo in Los Angeles under the Espionage Act. And in fact, there were a number of investigations during that period that haven't received much attention that we detail in the book. So there's a large-scale investigation of Beacon Press for their work in trying to publicize the Pentagon Papers. There are also efforts to investigate and subpoena much of the intellectual left in Boston, including folks like Noam Chomsky and other academics who are opposed to the Vietnam War. So we document many of these repressive measures that were fueled by the Espionage Act, as we saw throughout the Cold War, its use escalated and escalated, and you have someone like Nixon come into office, and he really, really expanded the use against the press.
How has the act been used in the so-called War on Terror?
So we outlined this third period, the War on Terror, where the use of the Espionage Act was really expanded as a prosecutorial weapon against disclosures to the press. So these are the so-called leak cases. It really began to expand under Ronald Reagan, where the national security apparatus received an unprecedented amount of resources. We saw introduction of new legislation such as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is a computer crime law, but it incorporated sections of the Espionage Act virtually verbatim. And we saw the first ever prosecution in the case of Morrison for giving documents to the press. So there's really a aggressive escalation of these prosecutions. And we saw that expand even further during the Obama administration. Of course, it's been covered how the Obama administration prosecuted more government sources inside sources who gave information to the press. The Obama administration prosecuted more sources than all previous administrations combined.
Carrie, please explain why the Espionage Act is such a dangerous statute in the legal arsenal of the U.S. federal government.
So the reason why the Espionage Act is such a dangerous law is because it effectively serves as a means of information control and an obstacle to the ability of the press to report critically about U.S. foreign policy and military engagement. And all the periods that we've spoken about, World War I, World War II, the Cold War, the War on Terror, and the ways that the Espionage Act has been deployed, we've really seen it be used as a way to limit public access to information about war. And it's really been used as a target against anti-war movements, as well as government insiders who wish to expose things like torture, human rights violations, or really just tell the truth that counteracts official narratives. So what we've seen happen, and it's really a disturbing thread, especially in the latter half of the 20th century, is that the legislative and judicial branches of the government have effectively given a blank check to the executive branch when it comes to secrecy and national security and cases under the Espionage Act. And we argue that fundamentally, this abdication of responsibility threatens the constitutional balance of power and the rule of law.
I'm curious, are defendants charged with violating the Espionage Act allowed to defend themselves by showing it was in the public interest to reveal classified information?
No, there really is no meaningful defense under the Espionage Act. In fact, the provisions of the Act do not permit any consideration of the value of leaked secrets to discourse about U.S. policy. They don't allow any challenge to the appropriateness of classification. And they don't also require a showing, in many instances, that the national defense was actually harmed by the exposure of a secret. So that's why when folks often call for instance, Edward Snowden to come to the U.S. and face trial, it's actually a disingenuous call, because there really is no opportunity to have a trial. The only element in that case would be whether or not there was a disclosure. There wouldn't be any conversation about public interest. In fact, court cases have held that evidence of that cannot even be introduced.
Carrie, you said that the Obama administration prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all prior administrations combined, and yet it decided not to indict Julian Assange because of the so-called New York Times problem. Could you please explain that?
Yes. Yeah, so as mentioned, the Obama administration did engage in an unprecedented number of prosecutions, as well as investigations and monitoring of the press in numerous cases. But towards the end of his administration, both Obama and his Attorney General, Eric Holder, walked back a bit on that and reportedly decided not to pursue a prosecution of Julian Assange for publications related to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Cablegate in 2010. They decided not to pursue that because of the so-called New York Times problem. And the New York Times problem says that you can't charge a publisher like Julian Assange for the publication of secrets without also publishing the media outlets that publish those same materials. Of course, recall back to 2010, it wasn't just WikiLeaks that published the materials that were allegedly leaked by Chelsea Manning. It was, in fact, a consortium of media outlets throughout the world. Some folks engage in debates and say, well, Julian Assange is or isn't a journalist. And in fact, in a legal sense, that's completely irrelevant. So whenever you hear folks saying, well, this is or isn't journalism, for one, I personally disagree with those contentions. In fact, the methods of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have been adopted, actually, as journalistic practice, such as relying on libraries of original documents, using secure communications. But aside from that, those questions aren't even elements in the Espionage Act. So that's really the reason why Obama decided not to proceed with that case.
When Julian was residing in the Ecuadorian embassy in London under a grant of asylum, the Trump administration planned to kidnap and or assassinate him. The CIA illegally spied on Julian's visitors, including lawyers and doctors. Can you elaborate, please, on that?
Yes. So towards the end of Julian Assange's time in the Ecuadorian embassy, the political situation in Ecuador became more tenuous, and his asylum shifted from protective status to a means of surveillance. There was an expose in the Spanish newspaper El País at the time that revealed that the Spanish security contractor employed by the embassy was actually spying on Assange, as well as visiting lawyers and journalists, including Ellen Nakashima of the Washington Post, and sharing that data with the CIA. There's actually an ongoing lawsuit that was filed just some months ago challenging the CIA's involvement in this case. Another investigation by Yahoo News revealed that senior officials within the CIA and the highest levels of the Trump administration discussed killing Assange, and they requested, quote, sketches and, quote, options for his assassination, including gun battles on the streets of London. So these instances really recall, dating back to Daniel Ellsberg, Nixon's plumbers famously broke into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office and also spied on Ellsberg's lawyers. And in fact, there's so much misconduct in that case that it led to a federal judge dropping the prosecution against Ellsberg. So what's happening in the Assange case and some of these revelations really calls back to some of that prosecutorial misconduct in past Espionage Act cases.
Yes, and Kerry, I think the reason that the Trump administration and particularly his CIA director Mike Pompeo felt so threatened by Julian Assange was WikiLeaks' 2017 revelation of the Vault 7 CIA surveillance program, where we were being surveilled. They would turn our telephones into surveillance devices, and this really incensed Mike Pompeo, and I think that led to some of these plans to so-called kidnap or assassinate him, and I think Trump himself actually asked for some of these plans to be developed.
Reportedly, it's right that the Vault 7 disclosures were, so to speak, the straw that broke the camel's back, and something that we see is that, at least what was reported, was that CIA pressure and pressure within the surveillance apparatus is really what drove this case forward. Because as you mentioned earlier, the Obama administration chose not to prosecute Julian Assange, and the current indictment doesn't allege anything different than what the Obama administration already had. It doesn't talk about anything past maybe 2013 or 2014. So really there is a political decision that was made to prosecute in 2019 as opposed to 6 years earlier when Obama and Holder decided not to.
So the Trump administration
did file charges against Julian Assange, and of course the Biden administration is pursuing the case against him. What is Julian charged with?
So in 2019, there were two indictments. There's an original indictment, then a superseding indictment that was filed. It was completely unprecedented in the century-long history of the Espionage Act. So Assange, who's neither a government insider nor even a U.S. citizen, was charged for the publication of secrets as well as his activities leading to publication. So the indictment included 17 counts of violating the Espionage Act, plus an 18th count of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. Collectively, these carried a possible 175-year sentence. At the heart of the indictment is conduct describing Assange's alleged requests of information from Manning. Publication charges reference alleged unredacted disclosure of informant identities. Gabe Rotman, who's an expert on the Espionage Act at the University of Virginia Law School, observed that the focus on informants was actually a red herring because there's no element in the Espionage Act that turns on this. The indictment also presented no assertions or evidence of actual repercussions for publications, which the government had already failed to establish at Manning's court-martial. In the entire history of the Espionage Act, this was the gravest threat to reporting because the described conduct alleged activities that are engaged in every day by national security journalists. So that's the relationship with sources, communication with sources, alleged requests for documents, et cetera. And this is conduct that's engaged in by any national security journalist for any national paper.
Kerry, in January 2021, a UK district judge denied extradition of Julian to the United States. That was because of his high risk of suicide due to the harsh conditions here in U.S. prisons. What has happened in Julian's case since that ruling?
So since then, the United States appealed the outcome of that case, and they entreated the UK with assurances that Assange would not be subject to extreme detention measures if extradited. These assurances were submitted after the case had already been decided, and they carried a number of caveats and loopholes, but nevertheless, a British appeals court accepted them, and subsequently, the UK signed off on his extradition, opening up another avenue for appeal. So Assange has been granted leave to appeal to various UK appellate courts, teeing up a lengthy legal process and ensuring that none of the questions of his case would soon be resolved. We may see some movement on some of these appeals in the coming months, and if remedies aren't found within the UK courts, there may be some possibility of appeals to the European Court of Human Rights, which is a pan-European court where individuals can appeal their cases after they exhaust all domestic remedies for potential blocks to extradition. And there's perhaps some hope there because the European Court of Human Rights has historically often been unsympathetic to U.S. assurances because of the really abysmal and grim state of detention in the United States. Of course, there is a fairly broad consensus that if Assange were extradited to the United States, he would face the most severe detention conditions and be at risk of threats to his life in facilities like a supermax prison or extended or indefinite isolation.
Kerry, we're coming to the end of our allotted time. Could you briefly tell our listeners what are the fundamental flaws in the Espionage Act, and do you think it should be amended or repealed? And if it is amended, what changes would you recommend?
Circling back, the underlying problem with the Espionage Act calls back to its original passage that it's called an Espionage Act, when throughout its history, it's really been used for all these instances of information control rather than espionage as we would traditionally understand it. And so the front and center proposal, and there's really a consensus among First Amendment experts and on both sides of the political spectrum as well, that there should really be separate legal frameworks for dealing with traditional spies, for dealing with government officials who leak to the media, and for dealing with the press and members of the general public that are publishing on national security information. Of course, we argue, and consistent with the First Amendment, would be that the highest protection should be afforded to the press, and publishers should be immune from prosecution under the Espionage Act or any similar law. We ultimately favor abolishment of the Espionage Act, and of course, as we discussed, there's no opportunities to mount an effective defense. Now, there's some efforts on Capitol Hill to try to reform the Espionage Act and introduce amendments. There's some lawmakers who just in the past year have tried to attach amendments to the Act. We have been seeing a growing effort to try to reform the Act, but it's truly a heavily political, and a highly problematic and contentious law.
Kerry, how can our listeners follow your work?
So myself and Ralph Engelman, who's a senior journalism professor at Long Island University, also the chair of the George Polk Awards, which is one of the most prestigious awards in journalism, we co-authored The Century of Repression, the Espionage Act of 1917, and Freedom of the Press. We really wanted to create a resource that could go on moving forward. So I encourage folks to check out the book, not just recommending it because I wrote it, but it was really a labor of love, if you will, for the two of us who've been thinking about these issues for close to a decade.
Kerry Shankman, thank you so much for being our guest today and for your really important book, which I highly recommend to everyone.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Sleepwalking into another Great Depression. It's breathtaking. You know, for folks that are listening to this, I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. See you then. Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. If you're on Twitter, we're on Twitter handle TheTaxCast. And if you want to make sure you never miss a TaxCast, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Nelson Mandela famously said, "Education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world." Yet millions of children in the world still don't even get to walk through the school door. This month on the TaxCast, education and tax justice, the challenges and the ways forward. Most of us have a story to tell about teachers who changed our lives and inspired us. I asked my family for theirs.
Oh yes, my history teacher was brilliant. This was in my first year in secondary school and he wanted to teach us about the fall of the Roman Empire. So instead of telling us about it, he basically acted out the whole of the fall of the Roman Empire as if he had loads of plates on sticks, and he ran up and down the classroom pretending to spin all these plates and showing how there were so many plates spinning that they gradually started falling off. And that was my history lesson, and I've never, ever forgotten it, how empires collapse. And I attribute to that the beginning of my interest in colonialism. That's my sister. I was lucky enough to have the same teacher, Mr. Smith, he was called. He really fired our imaginations and he helped us do things like create an imaginary nation where we all held positions of power and we planned how we'd run things. We called it the Nation of Rumbovia. He really made us think. Here's my parents' teacher memories.
Mr. Kirkham was a very dapper, quite small man, and he was our music teacher. He taught me how to sing, and since I've been deaf-ish all my life, it's had a particular value for me. I'm quite sure in my own mind that it's helped me with my hearing. He encouraged us to form a music society. He also used to invite former concert performers who'd come along and perform for us. I used to sit there with my eyes closed concentrating on music. And so all of that stayed with me all my life. I cannot tell you just how valuable for me that has been.
My idea of an inspiring teacher is my music teacher, and her name was Miss Ward, Betty Ward. I had a wonderful musical education with her. She taught us the history of music and the development of music through the ages. I'm now at the age of 76 and I have never forgotten anything that she taught me. Something reminds me of her every single day. I'll never forget her and I'll never forget the influence that she's had over my life.
Our teachers live on forever, don't they? Education changes everything. Article 26 of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is supposed to help guarantee the right to a free education for girls and boys. Most countries have signed up to that, and it's a UN Sustainable Development Goal. Yet, according to UNESCO, about 258 million children and young people aren't in school. That's a staggering 59 million children of primary school age, 62 million of lower secondary school age, and 138 million of upper secondary age. That's a failure of government for sure, but it's also a question of resources, and that means we have to look at the tax systems, not just those of the nations facing the most challenges, but the global tax system too. We need to focus on some of the wealthiest governments and financial institutions that play such a central role in denying children's right to education by blocking fairer tax reforms and failing to tackle the financial secrecy that's bleeding continents dry. In so many ways, it's a continuation of colonial extraction. Liz Nelson of the Tax Justice Network.
What's important about what tax justice can do is about explaining to the wider public, to people in policy development, to governments, stakeholders, what is the impact of tax justice on the right to education as a result of tax revenue that's lost by governments, what the scale of it is, and who's responsible for this? Who is complicit in facilitating tax abuse that denies the right to education? And who's the main people, organisations, institutions who create a situation where tax revenue is lost from government, tax that corporations or the super rich could be paying, and how they use the financial architecture, including secrecy jurisdictions or tax havens, how they use that to evade and avoid tax.
So let's do some number crunching. Worldwide, countries are losing at least $483 billion in tax a year to global tax abuse, to the deep pockets of multinational corporations and wealthy individuals. The Tax Justice Network has worked with the GRADE Project to link the harms that's doing specifically to children's lives.
What we've done to try and illustrate the impact of tax abuse on fundamental human rights, and in this case, the right to education, is have a look at low-income countries and middle-income countries and look at the numbers of children who are not in primary school and could be in primary school if tax wasn't lost to those countries.
So this research looks at 63 low-income and lower-middle-income countries where 41 million of their children are not in primary school. Each one of those children out of school is a life and a family tragedy. It's also a national tragedy. Those 63 lower and lower middle income nations are losing an estimated $30 billion a year in tax revenue because of tax abuse by corporations and the super rich. Recouping that revenue would mean millions of those children could be sitting in classrooms right now as I speak. For a long time, when it comes to talking about funding education in lower income nations, the attention tended to focus on aid. But that's a mistake, according to David Archer of the Tax and Education Alliance.
97% of the financing for education comes from domestic sources. Only 3% of global financing comes through aid or loans or any of the different sort of international initiatives that are created. And yet in every international meeting on education, people spend 97% of their time talking about the 3% about international aid. They don't talk about the domestic financing agenda and how you can really make a breakthrough. There's a desperate shortage of financing, and we're not going to make a breakthrough until we get serious about talking about tax. And we've really been working to shift that framing and recognize that the education community need to become powerful advocates for increasing the size of the pie, looking at tax policy and increasing revenues through taxes.
In September 2022, there's been an unprecedented gathering of heads of state to discuss this global crisis in education at the United Nations. David Archer was there.
This was going to be the first time ever that presidents and prime ministers gathered to talk about the financing of education. Whenever you have an international meeting on education, you get the sort of ministers of education, but you don't get heads of state. So it was an incredibly important opportunity to convene heads of state. So this was getting education financing out of the education bubble and into a sort of wider dialogue. It gave an opportunity to talk about the strategic financing issues and not just look sort of myopically in a very narrow way at education financing, but historically has been the case.
Yeah, and we know from our work on tax justice, having worked in sort of so many intersections with so much amazing campaigning work happening all over the world on all kinds of rights and how to tackle inequality, we know that tax isn't always something that they've incorporated fully into their work.
Yeah, I mean, at this summit, we did succeed in getting a much more strategic framing to the dialogue on education financing. We talked about tax, we talked about debt, we talked about austerity and macroeconomic policies. We talked about public sector wage bill constraints and the impact that has on teachers. And we ended up with a finance call to action, which I think is really a very bold agenda, which reframes how the education community needs to think about and talk about financing and the action that is needed. And the action needed from the international community is not just creating a new pot of money, a new aid, but it is about how do you change and contribute to changes to the global tax rules, the way in which they're set and the way in which they're enforced, changes to debt, changes to the macroeconomic policy advice from the IMF, and particularly changes to how investment in education is understood as something which is genuinely an investment rather than just as sort of spending on education being treated as consumption, because education has such a sort of dramatic longer term effect on all other aspects of development. Investing in education is probably the soundest investment you could make economically as well as socially.
Absolutely. And let's talk about the IMF. They were invited, they didn't attend.
The IMF Managing Director, Kristalina Georgieva, was supposed to be on a panel on the financing agenda together with me and some heads of state. 2 days before the summit, she withdrew without giving a very good reason. So we actually ended up with, I think it was the Global Student Forum, started putting up wanted posters all over on social media and missing posters calling her out for that. And I was rather pleased, in fact, that Christiane Amanpour on CNN the next day challenged Kristalina Georgieva. She said to her directly, "You were invited to this summit to talk about education for the first time, a strategic discussion, and you didn't turn up. Why?" So I think the pressure is certainly being felt. Kristalina Georgieva said, "Oh yes, well, I wasn't at the panel, but I am on the job." And we're now trying to hold her to that and instigate over the coming months, and hopefully on a sustained basis, a serious dialogue with the IMF. In this whole history of education summits, the IMF has never been at the table once. And yet the strategic framing of education financing is all shaped by the IMF. It's policies around tax. And if the IMF is not bold and ambitious at country level in supporting countries to expand tax revenues in a progressive way, then how do you finance expansion of education? At the moment, the IMF solution every time is cut spending rather than increase revenues. And that's the fundamental choice that people have to make. And every time at country level in practice, it's cut spending. And the flagship policy of the IMF in its sort of austerity policies is constrain or cut the public sector wage bill. And that is particularly devastating for education because the largest single group on the public sector wage bill are teachers. And the largest, like 75 to 90% of spending on education is on teachers. So if you're being told to constrain your overall spending on the public sector wage bill, it's impossible to achieve without freezing or cutting spending on teachers. And if you freeze or cut spending on teachers, that's the biggest cost and the most important part of the education budget. So you can't make progress on education if you change that mindset, move away from public sector wage bill constraints, and actively encourage countries to spend more on the public sector wage bill because it's part of a transformation towards development. So the IMF has to come to the table. I think we will force them to the table. I think we're very close to getting them to come to the table seriously, and that will make a massive breakthrough. Because it is also their policy advice on tax. You know, the fact that their routine default is just to support, you know, increases in value-added tax rather than more progressive forms of tax. You know, we want to see progressive spending on education, which is a redistributive in itself, and it should be financed in a progressive and redistributive way as well.
Yeah, I mean, the IMF, as you say, it's consistently made austerity a condition of financing packages to nations which haven't got many places to turn, has caused real desperate human suffering. I mean, what you're talking about is the absolute opposite of what they seem to stand for. So you say you can bring them to the table. That's encouraging and positive in some ways, but what can be achieved in spite of the IMF?
Well, in the end, it's a battle country by country. In the end, it's about influencing national governments and ministries of finance to recognise that there are alternatives to the policy advice of the IMF and popularising the idea that you don't have to follow that IMF advice. See, the biggest power of the IMF is its sort of coercive policy steer through its surveillance reports, which happen sort of every 6 months, pretty much. It's not always the loan conditions. You know, a smaller number of countries actually take loans and therefore have difficult conditions imposed. But the steer, the economic steer, the mindset, the shared ideology, I think, between the International Monetary Fund and most ministries of finance is the root cause of the problem. Now, we can't hold the IMF to account ultimately because there is no effective mechanism for doing so. They're not a democratically accountable institution. National governments are, in most cases, and so we can put pressure on ministries of finance to look at alternative economic policies, think about different trajectories, and have the confidence to stand up to the IMF. But to achieve that, you need really broad alliances in national civil society holding the government to account. And that's where we need the people who are working on the tax and fiscal justice agendas to come together with people working on education, on health, on other public services. Unless you've got a broad enough coalition that is working coherently and consistently to demand alternative policies, it's actually very difficult to achieve. So that is where I think the change will happen. We can, in the meantime, expose some of the contradictions in the IMF, because the IMF's produce some nice policy documents and research documents globally, and then they ignore all of those when it comes to the country advice that is being enforced. So exposing that contradiction, I think, is important, but let's not hold out for too much hope for the IMF to suddenly convert into a progressive institution.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's true that with such an enormous institution, it seems very often seems like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. There's so much different thinking within that institution, but ultimately it's not translating into the active policies that we would like to see. But there's some routes forward. So tell me, what commitments have been made, if any, as a result of this summit and the conversations around it, and what happens next?
So we have the finance call to action that came out of the summit, which reaffirms the existing commitments that countries ought to be spending 20% of their national budgets on education, or 4-6% of GDP, but makes really bold new commitments as well about taking action on tax, both nationally to raise tax revenues in progressive ways to finance education and other services, but also international action, for example, for a UN tax convention. And it was wonderful that the Secretary General of the United Nations lent his support to a UN tax convention, which had been called for by the Africa Union Ministers of Finance. It's a really, I think, important moment. So you need national action and international action on tax. You need the same, really, on debt. There's so many countries who are spending more on debt servicing than they are on financing education or health. That is madness. There needs to be a major new multilateral debt initiative, and there need to be new debt workout mechanisms. The call to action made that very, very clear, as it also directly challenges the IMF to move away from the austerity policies that are squeezing spending on education.
Yes, always too much talk about costs of financing education when it's actually investment in education and in children. Let's talk for a minute about some new developments this month around the campaign the Tax Justice Network's been pushing for many years, a UN tax convention that would help wrest control of the power to decide global tax rules to the UN, moving it away from the wealthiest nations at the OECD, who are often the world's worst offenders for sucking tax revenue from lower income countries. A UN convention would be consistent with UN human rights principles, and it should offer a fairer place at the table for less economically powerful nations. There have been two major developments on that recently, which give some cause for hope. Here's Alex Cobham of the Tax Justice Network.
The context for these two things happening is that we've seen political leaders move. So back in May, we had the Economic Commission for Africa, the declaration of their finance ministers, and that's more than a quarter of the member countries of the United Nations calling for the UN to begin negotiations on a convention. And then at our event with the Global Alliance for Tax Justice at the start of September, the new Colombian finance minister also backed that call. So the two things that have happened since is really, in a sense, the UN system starting to reflect these political demands. First, we had a major report from the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, and he laid out exactly the case for a UN convention, showing in some detail how the OECD and all of the related institutions are really not very close to being globally inclusive, how they keep out a great many particularly lower income countries, in addition to not being highly effective even for their own members. So that's the Secretary General pledging to support negotiations if the General Assembly decides to go ahead. And now we've had the other shoe dropping, which is that we have a draft resolution presented at the General Assembly's second committee, which is the Economic and Financial Committee. And that's a resolution that simply calls for the beginning of negotiations and for the UN system to support those. That's an interesting development in a couple of ways. You know, we have this ping-pong thing at the General Assembly every so often, where perhaps the G77 group of countries will bring forward a proposal of this sort for an intergovernmental tax body, and then OECD member countries, like the United States, often Liechtenstein is kind of a key player for some reason, and the EU as a bloc and the UK, will tend to block those proposals before they go anywhere. But these are when they're effectively one paragraph in a bigger resolution, and that's quite easy to get deleted. In this case, we have an entire resolution whose only purpose is to begin negotiations. So you can't really tweak it and get rid of the bit you don't like. You're going to have to block the whole thing if that's what the OECD countries choose to do. And that's going to become increasingly public. So we'll have negotiations over the next month or so about the actual text. If there is some agreement at that stage, and particularly if the G77 force the question, then it will go to a full session of the General Assembly at the beginning of December for a vote. The G77 is more or less the group of lower income countries, in most cases actually former colonies of the high income countries, which is of course how the high income countries became high income and how everyone else became lower income. But there are 134 UN member states who are members of the G77, out of 190 something members in total. So the G77 always have the numbers if they decide to do something together. Now, in this case, the G77 hasn't put forward this resolution. We've heard that Singapore may have prevented unanimity, but it's always a bit difficult to know what's going on behind closed doors. However, your expectation is that because they've repeatedly supported these measures in the past, almost all of the G77 would support this. And so that just brings you back to the OECD. Now, the G77 know that they've got the numbers, but they want the OECD countries to come with them and, you know, negotiate in good faith. And the question is, really, will they? Will we see Germany, Spain? Will we see, less likely perhaps, the UK, maybe the US? Will they support this? Will they block it? Will they stand back and let it go through without supporting? We're going to find out all of that in the next couple of months. And for the first time, really, those major high-income countries are going to have to pin their colours to the mast. They can't block this in private anymore. So we're going to see if they're willing to block it publicly, or even to get behind it. Will those high-income countries continue to try to block this en masse and sort of insist on trying to keep making the decisions in their own club at the OECD, even though that's been shown to be pretty ineffective for them, never mind for anybody else? Or are we at the point where, you know, after 10 years of the OECD's corporate tax reforms really not delivering anything concrete, even OECD members are willing to try something that's a bit more transparent, a bit more democratic, and a lot more inclusive, and might actually end up being effective for everyone?
David Archer of the Tax Education Alliance.
We're very energised. We need a very powerful movement to be able to hold governments to account. And so there's a lot of work about how do we strengthen the global movement on education, bringing together the teacher unions and student union movements and youth activists with national education coalitions that exist already in over 100 countries, holding their own government to account. But that movement then needs to link with the wider movement defending public services as a whole and the financing of public services.
You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next week.